The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Maranos, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas of Mrs. Sylvia Binder, Sheindel Bas Mordechai Ben Yamin, Olel HaSholom, of blessed memory.
According to historians, in the year 1290, the number of Jews in Castile, central Spain, was approximately 800,000. This number does not include the rest of the Jews in Spain, which probably numbered between 300,000 and 400,000. All of them were observant Jews. One would expect, based on normative demographic change, that this number would have increased considerably over a period of some 200 years. Yet, at the eve of the expulsion of 1492, according to Harav Don Yitzchok Abravanel, there were only some 300,000 observant Jews in all of Spain. There were an additional 600,000 Jews who were converts to Christianity, or their descendants. From these numbers, we have an inkling as to the total number of Jews who had been killed or exiled over this period. Because if we start off 200 years before with 1,200,000, you would expect over 200 years, 1,800,000. I think it's total Jews. These are based on the number of 800,000 is really based on tax revenue and digesting the information. Evidently, much change occurred in Spain over these 200 years. That story is the subject of this lecture. I would like to divide this lecture into three parts. The first part is an explanation of the growing anti-Semitism that developed in Spain during this period. The second part is the story of how the majority of Jews in Spain were either killed or converted to Christianity. The third part is an examination of the status of these converts and the group which are commonly called Maranos. In a previous lecture, we covered in great detail the rising tensions between the Spanish Christian community and the Jews. From the time of the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, the church began to apply unceasing pressure to convert the Jews. But despite all of their efforts through preaching and discrimination, history records very few examples of Jews during this period who actually did succumb to these kinds of pressures and convert. In a previous lecture, we've already spoken of three such apostate Jews: Nicholas Donen, who was responsible for the confiscation and burning of almost all of the extant volumes of the Talmud in France in the year 1242. Pablo Cristiani, who preached widely amongst Jews of Provence and Spain that they convert, and engaged in a public disputation with Rav Moshe ben Nachman, the Ramban, in the year 1263. Ultimately, this Pablo Cristiani forced the Ramban to leave Spain. And finally, the third of the famous converts of that period was Avner. He was actually a Rav, he was a Talmud Chacham, who converted at the age of 60 years old, and changed his name to Alfonso Burgones de Valladolid, who published several missionary tracts in Hebrew and prevailed upon the King of Castile, Alfonso the 11th, to, according at least to one source, that the Jews eliminate the prayer, at least part of the prayer of Vilam al Shinim from the Shemone Esrei, from the Amidah, it's Birchas HaMinim, it's referred to in the Talmud, and the Minim are widely understood to be early Christians. He took this as offense, even though it could be interpreted differently, but that's the way it was understood. And he also prevailed upon the king to remove a portion of the Olenu, which is the section which reads, Shehei Mishtachavim Lehebel Varik Umispalim El El Lo Yoshia. Now, for they prostrate themselves to vanity and nothingness and pray to a God that will not save them. And then it continues, Vanachnu. This verse is actually taken from Yeshayahu. It's a verse in Isaiah 45:20. Initially, at least, it did not refer to anything involving Christianity. However, this Avner pointed out that the gematria of Vorik, Shemeshtachim Hevel Vorik, is nothingness, equals 316. Now, Vav is 6, Resh is 200, Yud is 10, and Kuf is 100. The gematria, the numerical value of Yeshu, is 316. It says, aha! And on that basis, it was eliminated. To this day, most of the, at least when I was growing up, the Sidurim, they said, did not have this. Now, through Art Scroll and other Sidurim, have reintroduced this. At the same time, feelings of anti-Semitism by the general populace were constantly growing. From a historical point of view, there exist several valid reasons, in addition to Christianity, for this increased anti-Semitism. First of all, from the mid-13th century and on, following the defeat of the Moors and the reconquest of virtually all of Spain by the Christian forces of Castile and Aragon, the Spanish Christians began directing their resources and manpower away from military pursuits and towards growth in all economic spheres. The Jews, who played an invaluable commercial, military, and societal role in the years of the Reconquest, now became their competitors. This is especially felt by the lower classes, who were struggling to rise from poverty and view the Jews as a major source of their misery. This was compounded by the fact that the church forbade Christians to lend on interest. Without interest, Christians of means refused to risk their capital to make loans to other Christians. This left the field of money lending open to the Jews, who were allowed to lend to Christians with interest. The pressure repaying their loans with the accrued interest only fuel the resentment of Spanish Christians towards Jews. In addition, the citizens of the cities of Spain, after the completion of the Reconquest, were embroiled in a difficult struggle with the monarchy to assert their own independence and rights. It was like a mini struggle, political struggle within Spain itself. This, who was going to have the ultimate power, the king or the citizenry? And the citizenry, their power was in the cities. During the Reconquest, in order to gain the support of the citizenry, the kings kept on giving more and more rights to the cities. The Jews, a foreign body in their midst, who were not subject to the laws that govern the Christian citizens of the cities, and who by royal edict controlled the collection of taxes and many royal offices, were viewed by them as the embodiment of their adversary, the monarchy. The Jews, when they had a court case, did not go to the city courts. They went to the Beis Din. And when there was a controversy between Christians and Jews, they didn't go to the normative courts, but a separate royal court was set up. It says, in which the Jews and the Christians, adjudicated their issues. But the cities had no control over the Jews. The Jews didn't pay taxes to the cities. The Jews had their own. There were Jews in mixed neighborhoods, but by and large, Jews lived in their own neighborhoods and were a separate entity and were taxed separately. So really, these cities looked at the Jews as really as their, as really as the embodiment of the monarchy. You know? And they really wanted, they kept on struggling that to get all the power away from the Jews. The Jews should no longer collect taxes. The Jews should be adjudicated in their courts. As Jews should become citizens of their cities. And they really resented the Jews. From the Torah's perspective, we've discussed now three reasons, at least historians give, as to the anti-Semitism. Christianity, which was, one can't underestimate that influence. Competition. I mean, the same complaint about Jews has gone through the ages. The Jews are intelligent, they're very motivated, they're very focused. It's very hard. They feel that in this country, in medicine, in law, in different areas, the Jews are well overrepresented. Look at the number of Nobel's as prize winners. This competition bothered them. And of course, then there was this political struggle. If you have on your handouts on the first page, we discuss another reason for the anti-Semitism. There's a Gemara in Bava Basra and Sadek Aleph Amud Beis, 91b. The Rabbi Yochanan was describing his reminiscences of the past. He remembers as a young man, I remember the time was when said in the house of study, he that agrees with them, that's referring to the non-Jews, falls into their hands. As to him who trusts in them, whatever is his becomes theirs. In other words, he looks that the plight of the Jews in Golus and their suffering as a result that they want to find favor in the eyes of the dominant non-Jewish majority. And that is the reason that they suffer so much. I mean, it's a divine retribution. What we've discussed up until now are historic reasons. This is really a divine reason. We find furthermore, here's on paragraph B, this is from a Gemara in Pesachim, Kuf Yud Ches Amud Beis, and I'll just read from the end of this quote. What caused Israel to be scattered among the nations? The approaches to the nations which they desired. In other words, to the extent that they wanted to assimilate, life became much more difficult for them. This is how the Talmud views this. Interestingly, the Midrashim have a similar view as to the onset of the terrible subjugation that the Jews experienced in Egypt. As we know, originally when the Jews came to Egypt under Yaakov and Jacob and Yosef, they were treated very well. And gradually there was a change. The Midrash describes, there are two Midrashim, I believe complement each other, but describe what was the cause from a divine viewpoint, a providential viewpoint, of the heightened anti-Semitism. And just again, you can look at the whole thing. I'm just quoting now from the bottom here, paragraph C. It's in bold print. They said, referring to the Jews, let us become like the Egyptians. And as a result, they ceased practicing circumcision, which is really the sign of the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. And it goes on, the Medrash say that really the reason why is that a Melech Chodesh, a new king who arose, who created this terrible legislation, was a result of the Jews who wanted to assimilate. As you want to be like them, we'll give you a taste of what it's like. And finally here, again under the heading C on page 2, it reads, Vatimole ha'oretz osam, that the earth was filled with the Jews. The Medrash here, there's a Medrash Yalkut Shimoni, Rabbi Yochanan said, they filled the land of Egypt. As one is in terms of the growth explosion of population. Another explanation, the theaters and circuses became filled with them. So it's all the ball games. Immediately they decreed that they should separate themselves from them. And there's the reason that this occurred is the Jews really wanted to become like them. Providentially, life became difficult that they lost their desire, so to speak. In other words, if the Jews originally, according to the Midrash, did not have that desire and wanted to remain a distinct spiritual entity, nothing would have happened to them. This is how the Midrash views this. In addition to the idea of just general assimilation and wanting to find acceptance, on page 2, paragraph D, I quote here, this is a Gemara in Brachos and Samach Gimel Amud Aleph in 63a. It says, Omer Avitabi, Omer Abyeshia, who is so faint in the study of Torah will have no strength to stand in days of trouble. And then Rabbi Ami, says Matona, said in the name of Shmuel, even if only in the performance of a single precept, one will not, when trouble comes, one will not be saved. That sense we find, to give you of the picture of life in Spain, at least we have a picture in the middle of the 15th century from one of the leading rabbis, Rav Yitzchak Arama. He wrote a classic called Akedas Yitzchak, and this is Parshas, this is Vayera, and I'd like to read it with you. It's the top of page 3. It gives you a sense of the of what life was like in Spain then. This is the situation regarding the sins. He's speaking about Sodom, about Sodom and Gomorrah. This is the situation regarding the sins of the individuals of any community who breach one of the prohibitions of the Torah, such as non-Jewish wine or cheese or shatnez and the like. And the judges make themselves oblivious to their actions, and the leaders allow these individuals to do these things as if it were legally permitted. By doing so, they have transformed a private sin of an individual into a communal sin. How many times have I showed my indignation about the prostitutes in our community because the legal authorities of the generation do not view their actions as being absolutely forbidden? Not only that, but in some communities they are officially tolerated, and others they provide them with support from the community. They rationalize this by saying that by doing so they are saving unmarried men and fools from the severe prohibition of adultery, from the danger of having relations with non-Jewish women. This was prohibited by the non-Jewish authorities to have relations, and it carried with it a death penalty. This is already in the middle of, this is in the height of the anti-Semitism of Spain. And it is better to violate these negative prohibitions than coming to violate a more severe prohibition whose punishment is stoning, which is adultery, or being in danger of being sentenced to burning at the stake in terms of having relations with a non-Jewish woman. I debated with them many times in the presence of their notable scholars. Evidently, even the Rabbonim, as notable as allowed this. And I explained to them that a grievous sin which an individual violates in secret without the knowledge of the public or permission of the Beis Din of the court is an individual sin. However, a small sin which the public acquiesces to and the Beis Din does not protest is an act of licentiousness and is a terrible offense and a sin for the entire community. Such a sin will only be forgiven with the punishment of the entire community, such as was the case of the members of the tribes of Benjamin, because of their involvement in the sin of only some members of the tribe. And this is the story of Pelegish Begiva of the concubine and Giva at the end of the book of Judges, Shoftim. This was the sin of Sodom. Despite all of his pent-up resentment, the Jews were protected by and large by the king. Jews provided valuable service for him in areas of tax collecting and finances, and formed a needed and loyal mercantile intellectual elite, which greatly enhanced the country. In addition, although the church was actively attempting to convert the Jews, church policy dating back to Pope Gregory I in the late 6th and early 7th centuries officially forbade forced conversions. All of this came to an end beginning with the reign of Pedro I in 1350. Pedro himself was a protector of the Jews. His chief treasurer and advisor for much of his reign was a Jew, Don Shmuel Halevi. During his reign, Don Pedro was entangled in a life-and-death struggle with his half-brother, this is Don Enrique, or Enrique is Spanish for Henry. Don Enrique began his rebellion by capturing the city of Toledo and destroying a small and unwalled Jewish section of the city called Alcana and killing all of its inhabitants, men, women, and children, 1,200 souls in all. In the midst of attempting to overpower the larger and fortified Jewish section of the city, the king, Don Pedro, came to the aid of the Jews and forced his half-brother, Don Enrique, to retreat and abandon Toledo. Historians view the massacre of the Jews of Toledo as a successful strategy on the part of Don Enrique to ingratiate himself with the general populace. As we pointed out before, the city's burghers wanted to rid themselves of the Jews and were very supportive of his efforts. Eventually, Enrique fled and made his way to France, where he continued to undermine Don Pedro's authority by constantly referring to Don Pedro as King of the Jews. In fact, he fabricated a story about Don Pedro, that Don Pedro was actually Jewish. Don Pedro's actual Jewish mother, according to this fabrication, exchanged him for the king's infant daughter so that her son would grow up to be king and the king would have a male heir. Shortly after Don Enrique fled, Don Pedro began a war with the neighboring kingdom of Aragon. I mean, he wasn't a big tzaddik himself, this Don Pedro. Don Enrique joined with the forces of Aragon and attacked Castile, continuing to perpetuate atrocities against the Jews in order to gain adherence amongst the Christian populace. In the cities of Najara and Miranda, the Jewish population was decimated at the hands of Don Enrique. When Don Pedro gained the upper hand and recaptured the cities that went over to Don Enrique, he severely punished those that had massacred the Jews. In one town, he condemned to death 5 of its leading citizens, the perpetrators of the anti-Jewish atrocities. One of them he ordered to be boiled alive, and another to be roasted. All of these extreme measures, which were designed to instill fear in the hearts of the anti-Semites and to protect the general Jewish population, instilled even greater hatred towards Pedro, who now carried with him the appellation Pedro the Cruel. Now, this wasn't the first time he was cruel, but all of this, of course, increased Enrique's popularity. Almost 600 years before the rise of Adolf Hitler, Enrique realized that anti-Semitism could be a powerful tool to gain popular support. Eventually, Don Enrique fled a force of French mercenaries against Castile, and had himself crowned king. In city after city under his control, Jews were massacred or left completely destitute. Once he gained almost complete control of the country, however, his attitude towards the Jews changed. He knew well that he needed Jewish talents to support the economy of his new regime. He abandoned his anti-Jewish rhetoric and appointed 2 wealthy and well-known Jews from Seville, Don Shmuel Abravanel and Don Joseph Pichon, to run his treasury and tax-collecting apparatus. The suffering of Spanish Jewry, however, did not yet end. In the year 1367, Don Pedro gathered an army headed by Prince Edward, commonly known as the Black Prince, the son of the King of England, Edward III. His army defeated Enrique's, and again Enrique was forced to flee. The atrocities under Enrique paled in comparison to what the Jews experienced in the areas controlled by the English troops. Many Jewish communities were totally annihilated, and others, in sheer terror of the English troops, converted to Catholicism. This was the beginning of a process that drove the majority of Spanish Jews to conversion. Although Pedro was finally defeated and Enrique, once enthroned, ceased using anti-Semitism as a means to further his cause, terrible damage had already been done, with much of Spanish Jewry decimated, impoverished, or converted. In addition, strident anti-Semitic rhetoric now became the norm rather than the exception. Let me read to you the petition issued by the Cortes, the Council of Spanish Cities. This was their means of exercising their political influence, the cities, to Enrique in September of the year 1371. This is after Enrique was firmly in control of Spain. And this is their petition. Because of the great license and power given to the enemies of the faith, especially to the Jews, in all our kingdoms, in the court of the king, in the court of the nobles, because of the great offices and honors they have, which impel all Christians to obey and fear them and show them the greatest possible reverence, matters have reached the point that all the councils of the cities, towns, and places of our kingdom, and each of their individual persons are in the captivity of the Jews, that is, subjected and terrified by them, both because they see the high ranks they hold and honors they enjoy in the court of the kingdom, and because of the gathering of the revenues which they control and the offices they occupy in the administration. For this reason, the aforesaid Jews, brazen and evil people as they are, enemies of God, of all Christians, perpetrate with great daring many wrongs and briberies, so that all our kingdoms or their greatest parts are being destroyed and driven by the Jews to a state of desperation. And they continue on. Since it has been the king's wish that this bad company live in these kingdoms, let them agree in their mercy that they, the Jews, be marked and separated from the Christians as God has commanded, as the laws have ordered. Namely, that they wear signs as they do in other kingdoms, so they might be recognized among the Christians and be less inclined to cause so much evil and do so much harm as they are presently doing. Apart from this, let the king see to it that they have no office either in their own courts or in the court of any lord, nor serve as farmers of the royal taxes, offices by means of which they commit through their falsehoods many violations of rights. Since they have to live as bearers of testimony to the death of our Lord Yeshu. And this was by the way, this was the theory which was promulgated by St. Augustine, that not to kill the Jews, but just to make them suffer. They should always have an inferior status as a testimony. You see what happens if you don't accept, if you don't accept Christianity. Let them live and work only in the offices that suit them and to which they have been habituated as they live and work in other kingdoms which some of them inhabit. But all of this latent anti-Semitism reached a crescendo in the year 1391. As historians point out, events are not merely shaped by political and societal forces, but by decisive individuals who take advantage of those forces. Without them, the potential of the moment would never be realized. What would be with Russia if there would never be a Lenin or a Trotsky? A different story. The person responsible for one of the darkest moments of our history was a relatively minor Castilian priest by the name of Ferran Martinez, Archdeacon of Ecija, a town near Seville. Seville is in southern Spain. He was imbued with a fierce hatred of Jews, began preaching against Jews as early as the year 1378, urging the provincial city councils in the area of Seville to expel all the Jews from their confines. Although his pleas went unheeded, in fact, King Enrique wrote to all of the city councils and warned them not to tamper with the rights of the Jews, Martinez did not give up. Again, early on in the reign of Enrique's successor and son Juan I, Martinez was warned about his anti-Jewish activity. However, after the death of Juan's close Jewish advisor, Don Gedalia Negro, and his terrible defeat at the hands of the Portuguese in the year 1385, King Juan began courting the goodwill of the Cortes, the city councils, at the expense of the Jews. Ferran Martinez's activities were no longer checked, and he began an even more ambitious campaign, haranguing the townspeople about the iniquity of the Jews and urging them to destroy Spanish Jewry. His proposal to solve the local Jewish problem was to destroy every one of the 23 synagogues of the city of Seville, confine all the Jews to a ghetto, cease all contacts between the Christian community and the Jews, and to remove them from any position of authority. In the month of October 1390, Juan I of Castile died, leaving an infant son. During this period, Castile was controlled by a regency that was powerless and heavily influenced by the city councils. In this environment, on December 8th, Martinez issued orders to the various towns in the Diocese of Seville to destroy the synagogues in their locale. Many of the towns surrounding Seville complied. Appeals were made to the regency governing the country, and they in turn put pressure on the church leaders of Seville to rein in Martinez's activities. Despite warnings issued against him by the church authorities, Martinez continued with his activities and grew even more brazen. After 13 years of unabated incitement and what seemed to be the result of careful planning, the masses of Seville's population attacked the Jewish quarter at dawn on Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, the first the Hebrew month of Tammuz. It came out June 14, 1391. Poorly defended, the hordes of attackers broke through the walls of the Jewish section and butchered thousands of Jewish men and sold thousands of Jewish women and children into slavery. It seems, however, that in the face of this martyrdom, the majority of Seville's Jews chose to be baptized to avoid the fate of their brethren. The riots in Seville were only the beginning. The provincial towns surrounding Seville soon became the target of the pogromists, and the riots spread out from their city to the city of Cordova. Here, too, conversion was the route chosen by the majority of Jews. Following their success in Seville and Cordova, the masses of rioters swept through all of Andalusia, southern Spain, and made their way north to Toledo, where the same scene of martyrdom and mass conversion was again repeated. From Toledo, the pogromist movement made its way north to Madrid, Segovia, all the way to Burgos, which is in the northern part of Spain. Unlike the initial communities, the later communities did not even attempt to resist and converted en masse. From the pattern of the riots, it seems that the riots were led by the same core of conspirators, all agents of Martinez, who traveled from city to city, inflaming the populace and leading the pogroms. All of the events that we just discussed took place in Castile, in central Spain. Because there was no real king, he was merely an infant, and the country was controlled by a regency that lacked political will and power, there was nothing to stop the rioters in the course of events. In Aragon, this is in northeastern Spain, the picture was slightly different. Aragon had a king, Juan I, and when riots started erupting in Aragon, the king issued directives to the city councils and the governors, which denounced the rioters and demanded severe punishment. Despite the king's warning, on July 9th, the rioters attacked the Jewish community of Valencia, and after initial resistance destroyed the community and the overwhelming majority of Jews of that city, some 7,000 souls converted to Catholicism. After Valencia, Palma, the capital of Mallorca, fell on August the 2nd, Barcelona on August the 5th, Girona, the former home of Rabbeinu Yonah, and Ramban fell on August the 10th. As in Castile, the rioters moved from south to north, storming the great Jewish urban centers that had been the center of the masses' hatred and hostility. From contemporary records, we know that the pogromist movement in Aragon was not merely spontaneous, but rather was led by a corps of some 50 Castilians, all agents of Martinez. In April of 1392, the authorities of Aragon arrested a certain priest who was Martinez's nephew and put him into the prison of the Archbishop of Saragossa in Aragon. The king described him in his correspondence to the officials responsible for his arrest as, quote, the cause of the riots and destruction of our This is Alihama, or section of Jews. In addition, the king warned his jailers to guard him well and not escape. So, quote, for such people should not be allowed to live. The king also wrote that, quote, if Martinez comes to your city, referring to Ferran Martinez, says, send him to me or throw him into the river. From the Torah's perspective, these events must be viewed as a terrible gzeras, a terrible decree. A punishment a result of years of assimilationist tendencies and general religious laxity. The very fact that the majority of Spanish Jews opted for conversion rather than death, unlike the Jews of Germany and France, is itself indicative of a spiritual laxness. Although many who originally converted under duress eventually made their way out of the country and returned to Judaism, the majority of the converts, it seems, did not. Although historians differ as to the exact number of converts during the pogroms of 1391, Jewish sources seem to indicate that some 200,000 converted remained Christians. Although many communities were affected by the riots, many others were spared as the Regency of Castile and the King of Aragon eventually stopped the wave of pogroms. The events of 1391, however, planted the seeds of further conversion some 25 years later for those communities that were then spared. Perhaps the most prestigious convert of 1391 was Shlomo Halevi, the chief rabbi of Burgos, one of the most prestigious communities of Spain. Wealthy, well-educated in Torah, as well as secularly, he was fluent in Castilian and Latin and the works of the Christian scholastic philosophers. Shlomo Halevi was a brilliant philosopher, polemicist, and highly regarded in the royal court. When word came of the impending riots, Shlomo Halevi, together with his three brothers, his children, and his mother, and together with a group of his followers, converted on July 21st, 1391. By the way, his wife refused to convert. This was 3 weeks before the actual pogroms, which occurred on August the 12th. The vast majority of Burgos's Jews did not immediately follow their rabbi. Only after the riots actually began did most of Burgos's Jewish population convert. Many members of the community, however, refused to convert and were saved by hiding in the homes of wealthy Christian friends. From that point on, Shlomo Halevi, now christened Paul or Pablo de Santa Maria, would become one of the Jewry's worst enemies, using his tremendous talents to attempt to destroy Judaism. Shortly after his conversion, Paul traveled to Paris, where he prepared himself for a career in the church. After 3 years in the University of Paris, he graduated as a Master of Theology. The church was involved in a struggle of its own at the time, known to historians as the Great Schism. From the year 1378, there were two popes. Pope Urban VI of Rome was accepted by the Italians, and Pope Clement VII of Avignon, who was accepted by the French and Spanish. In Paris, Paul of Burgos became very friendly with Pedro de Luna, Cardinal of Aragon, who was then residing in Paris as a representative of Pope Clement. Shortly after Paul's graduation in 1394, Clement died, and Pedro de Luna was appointed as Pope, and took the name Benedict the 13th. He's known by historians as the anti-pope, and is not the official pope, Benedict the 13th. His close friend Paul was first appointed to a high office in the Curia of Avignon, and in 1403 was appointed to the position of bishop of Cartagena in southwestern Spain, and official ambassador to the Castilian court. While there, Paul was appointed as major chancellor to the crown, tutor to the young prince, the future King Juan II, and became an intimate friend of King Enrique III, his wife Catalina, and his brother Fernando. Paul was now one of the most influential men in Spain. It was during this period that we find the monarchy of Castile taking a definite anti-Jewish stance. In 1405, new laws were instituted to prevent Jews from lending with interest, a major source of income for many Jews, and to force Jews to wear a distinctive badge, even those Jews who served in the royal court. In October of 1408, a new law forbade Jews from acting as tax farmers or tax collectors, both positions which had firmly been in Jewish hands for so many centuries. The purpose behind these laws was to prevent the Jews from exercising their traditional professions of money lending and tax farming, thus impoverishing them and preventing them from having any political or social influence. But more importantly, from a Christian standpoint, the crown from this time forward would have no vested interest in protecting the impoverished Jews. If they would again be subject to attack and forced conversion, they would remain without any protection. During this time, the papacy of Benedict XIII came under increasing pressure. The fact that there were competing popes was seriously undermining the church. I mean, it's part of their doctrine. In terms of, they only became official much later, but they view the pope as the embodiment of, of the will of God Himself. He stands in the shoes of the fisherman, of Peter. He had a lot of shoes at that time. In June of 1409, a church council was called in Pisa, where a new pope was elected, Alexander V. And the other two popes, Benedict XIII and Gregory the 12th of Rome, were officially dismissed by the council. The other two popes refused to abide by the decisions of the church council to step down, and now there were three popes. It's bad enough we have one pope. Under siege and pressure from all sides, Benedict XIII had to cement his position and keep Spain loyal to him. It seems that at this juncture, Paul proposed to Benedict that if he managed to convert all of Spain's Jews, the Spaniards would be eternally grateful to him and not abandon him and accept one of the other popes. Benedict acted upon this advice and appointed Vincent Ferrer, an accomplished Dominican friar whose life mission was to bring heretics and infidels to the Christian faith. Starting in May of 1411, in Murcia, in the Diocese of Cartagena, whose bishop was Paul, and working his way northward towards Toledo, together with a mob of friars, the flagellants, they used to beat themselves in public as a sign of penance, who inflamed the passion of the city's mobs, his fiery sermons aimed at the Jews, together with their fear of a repeat of the events of 1391, converted many Jews. The numbers, though, were initially disappointing, as the vast majority of Jews did not succumb to this pressure. Seeing that something more forceful would have to be employed in order to convert Spain's Jews, Paul used all of his influence with the Castilian crown to create legislation that would impoverish and humiliate the Jews and reduce them to the lowest grade in the social scale and ultimately force them to convert. On January 2nd, 1412, the regent, Queen Catalina, issued the following laws for northern Castile. Jews would now be forced to live in their own areas or ghettos, and they would have only 8 days to make the move. And there's no Jews who lived in mixed neighborhoods would now be forced and who's to say there's any room for them where the Jews were generally lived in crowded conditions as is, which is very similar to what happened when the Germans took over. They would not be able to have warehouses, shops, or tables for selling even in their own boroughs. Not only were Jews not allowed to be money lenders or tax farmers, but also no longer to serve Christians as smiths, carpenters, doublet makers. The doublets were the tight-fitting jacket was used by the nobility, in the end of the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. Tailors, cloth workers, shoemakers, butchers, carriers, or clothiers. Nor could they sell them bread, flour, butter, or any edible thing. Jews were also not allowed to serve in the medical profession, even for other Jews. Jews were not allowed to shave their beards or trim their hair. Jews were not allowed to employ Christians as plowmen, shepherds, or herdsmen. It is evident that these laws had one thing in mind: to make life impossible. But these laws carried with them a stipulation that made it even more onerous than the writ of expulsion issued 80 years later. At least in the year 1492, if Jews wished to remain Jews, they could always emigrate. This was not the case in 1412. Article 23 of this edict read as follows, quote, "All Jews and Moors departing from my kingdom and dominions and taken in the road or any other place shall lose whatever they have with them and be my slaves forever." The purpose of all this legislation, as Professor Bensia Netanyahu pointed out, had only one goal in mind, the forced conversion of all the Jews. Fernando, the brother of the former king of Enriquez III and regent of southern Castile, issued a similar, if less onerous, decree in June of that year for southern Castile. In other words, Catalina had one portion, was under her control, and Fernando had the other portion. In that month, Fernando was elected king of Aragon. And in March of 1413, the same laws were passed in Aragon. These laws were enforced for at least 7 years and were unfortunately highly successful. Yeah, I'd like to read to you from the words of Shlomo Alami, a contemporary author, who described the condition of those who were forced to leave their homes in a mixed neighborhood and find shelter somewhere else. "People who had been well protected in their homes were ousted," this is a quote from him, "from their dwellings to find shelter in caves." They couldn't even be in homes. "Others live in huts in summer and winter, with hungry infants crying in the bosoms of their mothers, and with boys and girls dying from exposure to the cold and snow." Referring to the economic strangulation of the decrees, Rav Alami wrote, quote, "The majority of the tax gatherers were converted when denied the right to farm and collect taxes. They knew no other profession from which they could derive a living." And he continues, "On account of the pressing situation, a part of the artisans were also converted. They were cast down by these trials and tribulations and could not rise again." The period of these decrees is described by Sefer Yuchsin, or Avrom Zakuta, as, quote, "the largest forced conversion has ever taken place in Jewish history." In the words of Sanctodus, the Augustine friar who wrote Paul's biography, this is after Paul had died already in 1590, Paul, according to his biographer, quote, "organized, instigated, and made public by his influence in order to bring about the devastation of Judaism and the augmentation of the Christian religion," end quote. During this whole period, Vincent Ferrer continued his impassioned preaching throughout Castile and Aragon. The combined effect of the preaching and the anti-Jewish laws were devastating. But the Pope, in order to cement his support amongst Spanish peoples, wanted to dramatically display his role in the Jews' conversion. This he did by personally arranging a public debate between the leading rabbis of Spain, which including Rav Yosef Albo, the author of the Sefer Ikorim, and the leading church scholars headed by a disciple of Paul's. In other words, Paul, when he was the Rav in Burgos, had a Talmud. He had yeshiva. And when he converted, he influenced a number of his former Talmidim, former students, to convert with him. This was Yeshua Halorki, the personal physician of Pope Benedict's, known after his conversion as Maestro Geronimo di Santa Fe. Jews knew him, though, through his acronym. Maestro is Mem, Geronimo is Gimel, this is, di Santa is Dalet, and Fe is Megadef. That's his student, he's known as Megadef, the blasphemer. Although Lorki's arguments were much the same as discredited arguments of Pablo Cristiani, who attempted to debate with the Ramban and prove that the authors of the Talmud believed that the Mashiach had already come, we've discussed this at length in a previous lecture, Lorki must have felt that the depressing atmosphere of Spain in 1412 and 1413, full of desperation and fear, would hinder the rabbis from countering his arguments in a decisive manner. The disputation opened in Tortoso, in Aragon, in February 7, 1413. The opening session was attended by the Pope, his cardinals, most of his archbishops and bishops, some 1,000 special guests, including courtiers, noblemen, and notables from various parts of the Kingdom of Aragon. This was a month before the anti-Jewish laws of Castile were officially put into effect in Aragon. So this came together, again, to maximize the effect. After 9 sessions of oral debates that lasted for over a year, on February 20th, 1414, the parties began to argue in writing, presenting their views in detailed memoranda, read in common meetings, and then rebutted. Although, as was shown by the Ramban, the arguments presented by Pablo Cristiani and Lorchi were without rational basis, on April 19th, 1414, in the 60th session, Lorchi presented his final conclusion, according to which the Jews lost the debate. This was the official verdict. Which this did, however, was to present many potential converts to Christianity who would be reluctant to convert for purely social economic reasons, a face-saving excuse to convert. After all, the Jews officially lost the debate, and Christianity has, quote-unquote, been proven to be the true religion. The Pope was very happy with the outcome. On December of 1415, Paul was rewarded the position of bishop of the prestigious diocese of Burgos, where Paul was once chief rabbi. Although Pope Martin V, the one who succeeded the schismatic popes and became the officially recognized pope, issued a papal bull in January 1419, freeing the Jews of Spain from most of the limitations of the laws of 1412, the damage had already been done. The Jews were now reduced to a third of what they were before these conversions. In conclusion, I would like to add a fact that was touched upon in a previous lecture. The study of philosophy had been a subject of a long and fierce debate between the members of the community of Provence in Spain during the beginning of the 14th century. This I went in great detail in the previous lecture. It seems from historical sources, such as Rav Yosef Yavetz, a survivor of the expulsion, that those involved in philosophical pursuits were the least likely to sacrifice their lives or fortunes on a belief system that in their mind was highly speculative and for a god that was very remote. In addition, in the face of terrible Jewish suffering in 1391 and again in 1412, where rational answers were not forthcoming, a Judaism based on philosophy and rationalism was not very appealing. Those whose beliefs were based on simple historical fact and faith were able to withstand the enormous pressure and remain faithful to the beliefs of their forefathers. The unheeded warning against philosophical inquiry had a major role in the tragic loss of the majority of Spanish Jewry. I would just like to quote on page 3. This is on paragraph F. This is taken from the Geras Taimon. This is the letter that Maimonides, Rambam, wrote to the community of Jews in Yemen to strengthen them. You can look at the whole thing. But just it's very important to quote the end of this particular paragraph. This is the bottom of the page. Eventually, things will get so bad that even those up till now had no doubts will now begin to doubt and will err and wander in confusion. It will reach such proportions that only a few will still maintain their convictions. This is the Rambam wrote over 200 years before these events. But all this suffering really tended to give credence to Christianity's claim that the Jews are only suffering because they deny Yeshua. And seeing says, those who maintain steadfastly their beliefs were being tortured, were being discriminated against, were being starved, it created many, many doubts, again, where the numbers of those who were committed kept on shrinking and shrinking. All of these events created an unprecedented situation. There were now many hundreds of thousands of Jews converted to Catholicism, known as conversos, who, like the Jews before them, competed with old Christians in all areas of economic and political activities. Jews, after they converted, did not become any less intellectually advanced. They didn't become any less competitive. They weren't less overachievers. In other words, they were still Jews. You know, it's like this story. I think we've told this in a different class. You know, of a single Jew in a non-Jewish and in a Catholic community, where this was a time when they adhered to the strictly to the law of not having meat on Fridays, and there was one Jew in their neighborhood who kept on having barbecues on Friday night. And the smell would waft through the neighborhood, and they would chalish. I mean, they would just, you know, it'd just be terrible. So there was a committee of the neighborhood who decided the only way to rid themselves of this problem is to convert that Jew. So once he's converted, he'll eat milchiks too, he'll eat fish. So they all came and had a meeting with him, and finally prevailed upon him and convinced him, says, to convert. He went to the church. He was baptized. The next Friday night, again, they smelled the barbecue and the meat and the odors is coming through the home. And again, there was the committee from the neighborhood came to him. He says, what happened to you? He says, you became a Catholic. He says, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You know, it says, you sprinkled water upon me. You know, it says, born a Jew, says, now a Catholic. Says, I sprinkled water, says, on the meat. Born a cow, now a fish. they're still Jews. And they, like the Jews before them, became the subject of jealousy and hatred. Again, it wasn't a question of the cities. In other words, that factor was not involved. And nor was the factor, again, we stated really three factors, right? There was the cities, the Jews, well, now they're part of the cities. In fact, they're probably running city government, you know? There was no problem in terms of Christianity. They rose to the highest levels of the church. But they were still jealous of them. And they were very competitive. And these Jews that survived outshined the old Christian population. And again, they were the subject of all of this jealousy and hatred. Now, unlike the Jews, the remain Jews, they could not be so easily discriminated against nor marginalized as being infidels or killings of Yeshua. And as there was no means, how are you going to deal with them? Although the vast majority of those that decided to stay in Spain and not flee to areas where they could openly practice Judaism, such as Portugal and North Africa, eventually gave up Judaism entirely, they were still subject to suspicion and eventually to the fires of the Inquisition. Although the Jews were discriminated against because of their beliefs, as previously, and now they didn't have that, from the year 1449, we read of new racial theories similar to those that were later promulgated by the Nazis. That the Jews, converted or not, were malicious and criminally inclined people who were capable of the worst atrocities. And there was actually literature that was published at the time. In addition, a new myth was developed by Spanish anti-Semites. They now claimed that the Jews never really accepted Christianity, but their conversion was part of a plot to take over and undermine the church. The result of all this anti-Semitic fervor was the Spanish Inquisition, which was founded in the year 1478, and by the year 1483 was under the leadership of Dominican friar Thomas Torquemada. Fabricating the claim that the Jewish converts, the conversos, were still practicing Judaism in secret, and we'll see from Jewish, as this is also, as Professor Netanyahu points out, and we're going to see from the Jewish sources. He has a very thick volume. He has other volumes from Jewish sources, but really from Christian sources, to show that actually the vast majority of converted Jews were faithful Christians. There was a very small number of Jews that were secretly adhering to Judaism. You have to realize, 100 years had passed since 1391. Anyone who could have gone out would have gone out. And they sent their kids, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren were all in church schools.
They were loyal Christians. And for the most part, the whole idea of the Muranos, you know, in this romance of the Muranos practicing Judaism in secret, is a myth. I'm sure there were Yechidim, there were individuals. But it really didn't exist as a mass of Jews. Very few, almost non-existent. And we have a hard enough problem of Jews in this community who identify as Jews practicing Judaism. Nonetheless, people who've been Christians for 100 years. But because they fabricated the claim that the conversos were still practicing Judaism in secret, the old Christian Spaniards now had the means to undermine and destroy the gains made by their competitors, the new Christians, the Jewish conversos. This is one way to destroy your competition. Until his death in 1498, Torquemada executed thousands of supposed heretics and dispossessed countless others. I mean, we in our recent history, we know of the show trials that Stalin perpetrated, where people that were tortured confessed to the wildest, they confessed to all these accusations. They weren't loyal communists, and they were plotting the overthrow, and they were secretly Trotskyites, or whatever they were. Although the charge of being secret Jews were by and large unfounded, as we just said, the confessions obtained under torture and the wholesale terror that it produced gave an aura of truth to this myth. Under the pretext that the remaining faithful Jews of Spain were aiding and abetting their converted brethren, it was finally decreed that they should either be converted or forcibly expelled. The remaining Jews of Spain were finally expelled in 1492, and they were only a shadow of what was once a glorious community. This we will go in greater detail about the details of the expulsion in the next lecture. I would likely to briefly go over some of the rabbinic literature of the time in order to give us a better idea of the events that occurred and their impact from a halachic and historic perspective. I would like just on page 5, this is a fact, again, you should, on your own you should look at these, we can only quote from part of this, but it's just fascinating reading. The leading rabbi in North Africa, in Algiers, in the middle of the 15th century, was Shimon ben Semach Duran, called the Rashbats or Tashbats. We're going to quote from him a little later. But one of the works that he wrote is a commentary on Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos, the Rambam in his commentary, takes the position that it's forbidden for a rabbi to take a salary as a rabbi and should be employed by some other means. In the Tashbatz's commentary, he defends the practice of being salaried as a rabbi. But he also says that this was done only under duress, and originally they had all found some independent means of income. And he said, just we read the bold, you can look at the rest later. For we had property and we studied the science of medicine, which provided a respectable livelihood in the lands of the Christians. However, through the sins of the generation, forced conversion was decreed upon those lands, and we who survived remained just with our lives. We abandoned all of our property there. And as for those who had to leave, many made it out, but they had to give up everything. That which we managed to save, we were forced to give away to Gentiles as a bribe in order to maintain our principles and to avoid being forcibly converted. Speaking about the fact that he could not practice medicine, I guess it was not held in high repute, in North Africa, he had been trained as a doctor. He says, he continued in the bold, it is not possible to return to the land of the Christians in Spain because of the disturbances in those places. Every day new decrees in Shmad, forced conversions are promulgated. As it's stated in the Midrash, one who is bitten by a snake is frightened by the sight of a rope. Like, you don't want to even get close to it. And that's why going back to Spain is not an option. There's another response here, and it makes it fascinating reading. From a humanist interest point of view, it makes from a psychological point of view, it's also fascinating reading. But we just wanted to take in terms of the understanding of the history and the social background here. On page 6, this is from a response that he wrote, and this is the question. In addition, you asked about someone who left his wife in Mallorca and fled because of the fear of the decree of forced conversion and abandoned all of his property there. The Gentiles arose and plundered all that he had in his house and forced his wife to leave the religion of Moshe. And this is typical of what occurred. So he was impoverished and forced to convert. Nothing remained in the house from all the objects that were there except for the merchandise that was in the inns. Evidently he sold merchandise in hotels. His wife, seeing all of this, hired out a boat for 150 doubloons to leave the land of the decreed forced conversion. And then she would come back, as outwardly she acted as a Christian. Finally she left, and then went back. She went to North Africa, and openly was a Jew. This was done despite the fact that the Gentiles told her that if she stays there, they would pay her for what was left in the inns, the equivalent of her entire ksuba, her marriage contract. Now, because of the strife that exists between her and her husband, the husband wants to divorce her. He claims that he is free from paying her ksuba because she left in haste, and because of her haste, he lost that which remained in the inns. Because it's her fault. He also claims, what a husband, claims that 150 doubloons, which he gave for the rental of the ship for her sake, which was taken from their money, should be deducted from her ksuba. With such a husband, it's a good thing they got divorced. This was from a tshuva of Shimon ben Sema. Again, he lived again in the first half of the 15th century, in the 1400s. He was a rov in Algiers. Again, this is also very enlightening here. Regarding my opinion as to the status of wine sent from Mallorca, as wine from a non-Jew, or from a Jew that is not a practicing Jew, a convert, is not kosher. Are these people practicing Jews or not? In other words, this wine that comes, and this is wine that's shipped, how do I view this? I feel myself inadequate to be asked such questions. This is evidently, he was, at this point when he's answering, he is not the chief rabbi, but he is one of many rabbis, most certainly in the presence of my masters, of whom I consider myself dirt under the soles of their feet. However, for the sake of the work of heaven, I will tell you what I feel to be the correct ruling. I will discuss this with my masters as I sit on the ground by their feet, as my opinion is that it is kosher. I say that it is possible to argue that the contact of wine of non-converts by the forced converts anusim, it is possible, renders the wine forbidden in pleasure. And it goes without saying that this ruling is applied to their own wine. It's possible to argue that if a forced convert who is practicing Catholicism touches the wine of a committed Jew, an observant Jew, it would render it unfit to eat, to drink. And to have any, according to he adheres to the, you can't have pleasure from it either. There is support for this argument in the words of the Rambam in the fifth chapter of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, Halacha Dalet, and Halacha 4. However, if a person can escape and flee from the domain of the evil king and does not do so, behold, he is like a dog who returns to eat its own vomit. He is considered a premeditated idolater. He will be driven away from the world to come and will descend to the lowest level of Gehenna. Behold, it is obvious that the Anusim were able to escape and to flee, as many of them had done. Now, so one could argue those who stayed made a choice. They decided to give up Judaism. It is, however, difficult to maintain that position for many reasons. He says, on one hand, you could argue this, but on the other hand, it could be countered. Therefore, I'm arguing for their merit in this situation. I would argue that in all probability, we cannot rely on our assessment and say that they were able to flee for their lives, and therefore they have this status of absolute idolaters. As we know, there were those who fled. But of those who stayed, we can't be so certain as to what, you know, as to what the reason is. We can attribute their stay there to one of the exigencies that we know are likely to have occurred. One, the inability to get hold of the funds to pay the sea captain for the cost of the trip is exorbitant. They just didn't have the money. Two, the fear for their lives. Due to their sins, the plan of escape to live as a Jew may become known and will be subject to corporal or capital punishment for this crime. And three, they may have tried with all of their strength to flee, but confusion set in and the opportunity passed. You know, some, who's to say that they never tried? Or maybe some other exigency occurred. The words of the Rambam apply to a situation where none of the above situations were present. It was clearly known that he could have fled but didn't. And therefore, he wants to allow the use or the selling of the wine on that basis because there may be reasons why they didn't leave. But again, it gives us a sense of what the historic conditions were. This is Majorca. Now, again, they were forcibly converted first in 1391, and again, those who came back were again converted again in 1412. Now, in page 8, there's a question asked, again, the status of these forced converts. This is a response of Yitzchok ben Sheshes, the Rivosh. Therefore, those forced converts, Anusim, upon whom the sword of forced conversion, Shmad, passed, and remained there for an extended period of time between the idolaters, who decreed the forced conversion, and did not save themselves by going to another land to serve Hashem without fear, should be investigated as to their true nature. The Yitzchok ben Sheshes, the Rivosh, left Spain in the wake of the riots in 1391, and became the chief rabbi in Algiers. He was the master of the Tashbats. He was a superior. Some of them had the ability to leave that land and to save themselves from Shmad, but after they converted, if it was originally forced, threw off the yoke of heaven and tore the bonds of Torah off of themselves. They now willfully follow the statutes of the idolaters and violate all the commandments of the Torah. Furthermore, they pursue the unfortunate Jews in their midst to bring charges against them in order to destroy their nationhood and to obliterate the name of Israel. So we have already a group that's described, this is very early on, that there, once they've been forced to be converted, accept it. Also, the Anusim, those who were forced, whose heart is sincere, and who try to flee from the Shmad, those who at least they were forced to be converted, they really didn't believe in it, and now they're trying to escape, are the victims of the charges of these evil informers. The charges that these evil informers bring against them to the governmental authorities. You've heard about some of them, Valencia and Barcelona. Behold, them and their ilk have no portion in the God of Israel. It goes without saying they are invalid as witnesses. They are worse than Gentiles, even though they originally were forced into conversion. There are others that would gladly leave the Shmad. That's one group. But there are others, at least he's writing early on, where they don't have the financial ability to do so because of the exorbitant cost to pay for themselves, their wives, and infants. Perhaps they would have enough for themselves. However, they are fearful lest by leaving their family between the idolaters, they would assimilate and learn from their deeds and would never leave. In other words, they have enough money for one person to go on the trip by ship. They don't have for any more because they can't take their whole family. They don't have the funds. They choose to remain there in order to bring their family under the discipline of Torah, its commandments, until compassion will be shown to them from heaven and the gates of salvation will be opened up to them. We know historically in other places, in the wake of the mass destruction of the communities in Germany, you know, in the year 1091 in the First Crusade, those who converted, you know, in 1096, those who converted a year later, there was a decree issued by the king to allow them to openly observe Judaism. And in a later date, in 1146, in the Second Crusade, where again there were a number of Jews in Germany that were forced to convert, again, subsequently, there were measures taken that the Jews, again, they were able to get to France, and again, those who converted openly observed Judaism. Within Spain, we know historically, many years before, under the Visigoths, there were Jews who were forcibly converted, but the situation changed and they openly embraced Judaism. So one could perhaps, there were a number of them, at least originally had that idea. In the interim, they are careful not to become polluted through the impurity of transgressions, with the exception of the time of danger and the place of danger. Those people, even if the truth is they're required to save themselves, even if it means abandoning their children and family for the love of Hashem and His Torah, takes precedence over everything else, they are not invalid witnesses. The question was, if people got married, this is in Mallorca, and the witnesses were converted Jews, and a kedushin, a marriage, needs valid witnesses, are these valid witnesses? But again, besides the halacha, we see, in a sense, the situation, how it occurred. Again, you could look through the rest of the notes, but I would like now to continue on page 9 and 10 to give you a sense of what were these tshuvas. These responses were written shortly after the mass conversions, but 100 years passed. What was the nature of the Jews who remained, who never took the advantage of leaving, who raised their children as Catholics and their grandchildren as Catholics? We have two quotes here. With that, we'll conclude the lecture. One is from Yitzhak Aram, which we quoted previously. Nikedis Yitzhak, this is Parshas Kisovo. And he writes of the Jewish converts. This is amazing. Although they assimilated with those nations completely, they will find no respite or rest among them for the soles of their feet, for the nations will always revile them and shame them, plot against them or falsely accuse them in matters of faith. Indeed, they will always suspect them as Judaizers and subject them to tremendous dangers, as has been the case throughout this period of innovations, especially in our time, when the smoke of the auto de fe has been rising towards the sky in all the kingdoms of Spain and the islands of the sea, as Mallorca. A portion of them were burnt to death by fire, a portion fled in every direction to find some place of refuge to hide, and the remainder live in tremendous fear and extraordinary cowardice brought on by the fear in their hearts and what they saw with their eyes. Evidently, Yitzhak Alama, who was the Rav of Spain, who would know intimately what was happening, viewed that those people who were the object of the Inquisition were actually assimilated Jews. And all the charges were brought against were trumped up charges. And yet on page 10, this is from the Abarvanel, Ravanel, who was a contemporary of the events. He was very close to the inner workings of government. And he explains as amazingly as a pasuk in Yecheskel. In the Novi Yecheskel, this chapter 20, verse 33. As I live, says the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out, will I rule over you. Even though they and their descendants will endeavor to be like complete Gentiles, they will be unable to achieve this aim. For the native peoples of the lands in which they live will always call them Jews, mark them as Israelites against their will, and falsely accuse them of Judaizing in secret, a crime for which they pay with death by fire. Thus, again, he is saying that these charges are not true. All of this is included in the verse, and with fury poured out will I rule over you. Although they want to show themselves to be Gentiles against their will, they will be considered to be Jews. And I will bring you out from the peoples, this is the next verse in Ezekiel and Yechezkel. We'll bring you out from the peoples, I will gather you out of the countries where you are scattered with a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, and with fury poured out. In the end of the days, God will inspire the hearts of the forced apostates or their seed to return unto God and do some of their mitzvahs in secrecy. There are historians that claim, in fact, that in a sense the Inquisition was really counterproductive, because once these people who had the hope of living as Gentiles and all the suffering would be relieved and embracing the compassion of the church, saw what was happening, and they could never be accepted. Many of them rethought their whole connection and started practicing some Judaism in private. And this is what he's alluding to. This is a fulfillment of that which Moshe Rabbeinu, blessed memory, said, "You shall seek the Lord your God from there." He would then awaken the hearts of the Gentiles against them to pursue them for this, doing false charges against them, saying, "You were Judaizing, followed the religion of the Gentiles, that burned them by the thousands and hundreds with burning cruelty and flowing anger." Now, still, when they do some of the mitzvahs, they are not committed Jews. They are still practicing Catholics and believe like Catholics, but they are wavering a little bit. This we have seen in our generation, the kingdom of Spain. Because of this, he will awaken the hearts of those forced converts and their children, wives, and infants to flee and escape from the lands of their dwelling amongst the Christians, to travel to a distant land to save their lives. So really, there are two levels. Originally, it seems that they totally embraced Catholicism. Those who had not escaped originally. Only after the campaign was waged, which the campaign was a whole myth, and the confessions that were gained under torture, anyone, if you torture a person long enough and hard enough, they will confess to almost anything. We know over the confessions, we'll speak about this in the next lecture, about those who, there were claims that they crucified Christian children and they got their blood and desecrated the host and all these, which are complete fabrications. If a person's tortured, it just becomes insane and the person will admit to anything. But basically we see that originally it was all fabricated. It seems though afterwards, after the beginning of the Inquisition, that actually it did influence some Jews to start seeking their roots. This we do see from this. But again, the charges by and large were not for what they actually saw of them. In other words, that which they kept practicing secrecy could remain secret, but they still had these charges because they were wealthy and influential and got trumped up witnesses to just create these charges in order to bring these people down from their, you know, from their position. Okay, this ends this, you know, this part of this. We'll continue on in the next lecture about the events of 1492. We'll go through the biography of Yitzhak Abravanel, who was one of the leading figures of that time. And also we'll go through the story of Christopher Columbus and all the evidence to point that Christopher Columbus actually was a converted Jew. And to point out that the supporters, the financial support and the moral support of this voyage of Christopher Columbus was all backed by Jews. So are there now any questions?
Yeah. wasn't that the Jews that maintained the Jewish idea and separating themselves were, shall we say, less persecuted than the Jews that were assimilating? Or was it one size fits all?
Your question was about once the riots began and these decrees began, Jews who were assimilated in a better position, the Jews were not assimilated. In other words, Jews who had the outer, it seems on the contrary, the Jews who had the outer trappings of non-Jews were more greatly despised by the populace. They would have rather seen the Jews look like Jews and be far away from them, because those who actually looked like non-Jews competed with them. And they were the tax farmers, they were those who were involved in the, they had the position of control. Reminds me of the little story that the African diplomat came to Israel and asked a taxi driver to take him to the place. You know, says, well, they're Jews. He knows Jews come from, you know, all over, and they cry. And he drove him to the Department of Internal Revenue. The question about what was Paul's motivation. It's really hard to know. I mean, the truth is, it's really hard to know what Paul's motivation was. I would tend to think, without really knowing, he was a person who didn't believe in much. He believed in himself. And it was not very advantageous for a person of his gifts and talents to be part of the Jewish community. Not in the light of what occurred in 1391. And he found a very high position as within the church. In the process of him turning his back to the Jews, and of course I'm sure the Jews, as Jews are, make their feelings very apparent, and called him a traitor and looked at him as a shagetz and a traitor and oisvot and whatever titles and compliments Jews tend to give other Jews. He developed in that, in a sense, that really created that terrible hatred that he had towards other Jews, which is very often mishumodim, those who convert, because they know how they're viewed by the mainstream Jewish community who resisted these attempts of conversion. And they're looked as weak-hearted, as traitors, the converts. Because of that probably, again, we're only theorizing, that created that tremendous hatred that he had, which really he wanted to see that all of Judaism and Jewry would be destroyed. I really can't say. We know Kol Nidre is really predates that. The Kol Nidre we find in the literature of the Gaonim. You know, the question of being popularized. We know about the perhaps, you know, it says the Bishiva Shomisil Milo Shiva Shomata Onu says that we were giving permissions to pray with the sinners. I don't know. I really don't know. I know that is the common legend, but I really don't know if that. One would have to really research this. When did that part really initially come into the liturgy or not? But Kol Nidre, as itself, is very old. Is discussed in the, you know, by it's in the Gaonic literature. It's in the early Rishonim. Rabbeinu Tam speaks about this. Rabbeinu Nissen, the Ran and Dorim speaks of this. So actually, the Kol Nidre is very old. Because that section, it's really hard to know. Yes?
You spoke about that better than one and all of that, but I was wondering about that time period, and there was so much competition. Seems like going from what you were saying last year, seems like most of what was going on, the Jews were very much committed. How did they get to be very assimilated?
So, one major problem is, about the question is that the time of the Ramban, it seems Jews were very committed, which is really, we're saying, in the difference in 1290, where we have this census, you know, of 800,000 committed Jews in Castile alone. That doesn't describe as Catalonia and Aragon and the other areas of Spain. To where we now, says the where these mass conversions. One can only again theorize, but according to what we've discussed, there are two major areas of theorization. One, the fact that the study of philosophy had really spread very highly. In other words, the study of philosophy was highly was held in great esteem. Secular learning was held in great esteem. During this period that we're speaking of, Spain did not produce many great men of stature. It no longer was that great bastion of Talmudic scholarship that it had been in previous years. And general scholarship and well-balanced scholarship was given much greater credence. That's one factor. Another factor is the fact that just the culmination of all the, you know, of the tsoros, you know, of living as Jews, you know, tens makes ones, you know, if I do this, things will be easier, you know, so, you know, especially like in the later period, you know, there's a tendency of Jews as the Jews in Germany. Well, they don't like us because we're too Jewish. And if we become more part of their set, they'll love us. And really what happened, we know from their literature, is actually the opposite was the truth. And we know that's the same in Nazi Germany. The opposite was the truth. They said that they looked at them as competitors, they actually hated them more. But there was a tendency of, you know what, life will be easier for us if we're not so Jewish.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.